Hi, everybody. Ben Starr with you here with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And in the studio today with me, Kevin O'Donohue.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kevin. And special guest today, Dr. Michael Aaron. He's a clinical sexologist and certified sex therapist. You may have read his column in Men's Health magazine or on Psychology Today, or you may have heard him on the Huffington Post Love and Sex podcast, or seen him quoted in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and on CNN. Dr. Michael Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure. And as you know, over the fun drive, we were talking a little bit about sexuality and intimacy, and we thought we'd unpack that a little bit further today by having Michael, Dr. Aaron here, a very knowledgeable and very well-respected expert in the field, come on to share some information with us and shed some light for us on, you know, modern sexuality, both within individuals and in the greater overall culture. So, Dr. Aaron, thanks again for joining us. You say you do the majority of your work with sexual minorities. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I work with a wide variety of people. A big chunk of them, maybe 50% or a little bit more, are sexual minorities of one sort or another. Either they are gay or queer, or they identify with an alternative lifestyle, whether it's BDSM, kink, or polyamory. And they seem to have two main kind of issues that they seek me for. One is that they may be in some sort of a transition, so they may have realized that there's this part of their sexuality that they weren't aware of before, that they were suppressing or something, and they want help sort of transitioning into a place of greater acceptance or integrating it into the rest of their relationship and the rest of their life. Others are people who already comfortable with who they are, but they want a psychotherapist who understands them, that they don't have to educate, they won't be judged or pathologized, they don't have to spend time explaining anything. So I do general psychotherapy with people like that.
Okay. And over the fun drive, one thing we talked about, Kevin, was sexual compulsivity and even sexual addiction. But Dr. Aaron, you reject the notion of sexual addiction. Tell me about that.
Well, I think sex addiction is a catch-all term that is often used by folks who have a very sex-negative approach to things. There are clearly individuals who are compulsive. There are people who have wasted all their money on prostitutes or can't stop watching porn at work and they get fired. And so these folks clearly exist, but there's an entire industry with inpatient 30-day stays that cost thousands upon thousands of dollars that has arisen kind of out of a media-generated hysteria over sex addiction that's fueled by kind of celebrity headlines and so forth. And if they just stuck with people who were just compulsive, there's not enough there to make the kinds of money that justify all the kinds of profits that they make in these inpatient centers and around the whole kind of idea around sex addiction that they've promulgated.
When you say celebrity-driven headlines and a lot of it is sex negative, immediately Tiger Woods comes to mind.
Sure.
Because when that was revealed, the amount of shaming that he received was overwhelming in the media. I mean, it was astonishing, really.
And Anthony Weiner.
And there's another one, Anthony Weiner.
Well, yeah, I have quite a few opinions on that. I was about to mention them. Tiger Woods in my book, but my publisher said I wasn't allowed to use his name. But look, let's take a look at these two examples. Tiger Woods, and we don't know much. We don't know them personally.
Sure.
Tiger Woods is a young guy, a young celebrity, a young handsome man who lied to his wife. The fact that he had the desire to have sex with many women who admired him or who looked up to his fame and his celebrity status, I don't think is symptomatic of an addiction. I'm not condoning the fact that he's a cheater or a liar, but the fact that he wanted to have sex with many women in the position that he was in, I'm not sure is something that is necessarily a pathological condition. In the case of Anthony Weiner, we have found out later that his wife you know, wasn't aware of what he was doing and all that. But my first thought was, what if him and his wife are both doing it and enjoying it? Maybe it's some kind of consensual play that they're, and that wasn't the case. But the headlines right. immediately assumed that he's a sex addict, although we didn't really have enough information.
Well,
about
it's like you say, we don't really know these people, and yeah. there is this sort of media frenzy when it comes to prominent, famous people's sex lives, especially politicians or entertainers, celebrities. There's this sort of assumption that we have the right to know, and I'm not so sure that that's true. Just because someone's in the public eye?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I think the way the media works is that they it's driven by big headlines. And it reminds me about 100 years ago, there was something called yellow dog journalism, where, in fact, I think the Spanish-American War was blamed in history books for this yellow dog journalism, where the journalists were egging on sort of conflict with these big headlines. And that changed a little bit because it kind of went into a subscription model where, say, the New York Times has a, and it still does, but it has a loyal subscription base. So they want to make sure that they can be trusted. They want to make sure that they have loyal readers that keep coming back to them. If they make a mistake, they'll correct it because it's a subscription model. But now with the internet, it's all one-offs. It's all page views and page clicks. And someone will read your article and never come back. And so they get paid by advertising on page views. So they want the most compelling, outrageous title available, and that's what drives the media these days.
We just and so often this is just not this is just plain unfair to the actual people that are dealing with what quote sex addiction. We wouldn't call it sex addiction. We should call it media addiction.
I like that.
You know, the media will blow out any kind of sex issue, and what you know, as a sexologist, I'm wondering what your reaction is to the development of this obsession with sex. I mean, yeah. we didn't even hear how great it would have been if Tiger Woods actually could talk in public about what went on with him. Instead, it's a total mystery. He went to rehab for a month or two and came back a reformed guy. Well, but we don't know what process he went through and whether it was actual sex addiction or compulsion or just, you know, marital issues.
Well, it's kind of an atonement, you know. I think, I don't know, obviously, again, we don't want to get trapped into making assumptions about people we don't know.
Right.
But I think for a lot of folks, I've seen this in my own clients, that they do some transgression, they cheated on their spouse or something, and it's usually men. Okay, I'm always wary of making broad generalizations, but in my practice, I've seen it's mostly men who have had this title, this label foisted mm-hmm. on them, and they have done something that was, you know, impaired their relationship and got them in trouble. And so they go to a treatment center, and it's sort of like an atonement, you know, sort of like a confessional, and now everything's good, and will you forgive me? And the truth of the matter is that a lot of the treatment that they get is kind of 12-step group focused, which I'm not criticizing, but I'm just saying that there's no panacea in a week.
Right.
And going there for a week isn't sort of going to make you a new person. And I think for some people, the sex addiction label is almost, they're attached to it because it kind of gives them an excuse for bad behavior.
Sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. it's a rationalization in a way, almost like I can't help myself.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm sick. You know, I didn't do bad things to you. I did them because not because I'm you know really wanted to hurt you. It's because I'm a sick person and I need help. And so I think that is really appealing to a lot of people to rally behind that label. But the truth of the matter is, it is not an accepted diagnostic label. It was rejected by the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry that came out, the DSM-5 that came out 3 years ago. And they tried to use the term hypersexual disorder, and it was rejected
right.
because it was the people who were putting it together said this does not pass muster in terms of being scientific enough.
In fairness, though, Dr. Aaron, didn't the DSM until fairly recently classify homosexuality as an illness?
Yes. It was 1973 that homosexuality was removed. And then they called it dystonic homosexuality rather than just homosexuality, which is ridiculous because if you're gay and you feel good about it, then you're not sick. But if you're gay and feel bad about it, then you have a mental illness. And that lasted up until 1980. So you make a very good point, because on some level, it is true that the DSM is also a political document that reflects the social mores of the time. They're trying to make it as scientific as possible. It's still highly subject to social pressure, social mores, and political judgments. And what's reflective of that, though, it continues to evolve, though. And you mentioned homosexuality. I wanted to make a very quick point. In the last DSM, they made a difference between paraphilias and paraphilic disorders. So paraphilia, let's just say, is a fetish, okay? It's just something that is not a common sexuality. Before, that was considered a mental disorder. 3 years ago. And then...
Just 3 years ago.
Like frauderism or something?
Yeah, frauderism. Frauderism is, you know, mm-hmm. rubbing your genitals against someone's behind. And that was considered and there were some qualifiers, but generally that was considered a mental illness. And then they said, okay, there's a difference between a paraphilia, which is not sick, and a paraphilic disorder, which is when you're doing something that's non-consensual, or it's causing you distress that's not societally created, which is still complex, because how do you separate distress that's distress on its own versus distress that's societally created distress?
So you're saying that until very recently, all fetishes were considered a mental disorder? Or certain types of fetishes?
Yeah, there were. That's a good question, because there were, I think, 7 main types, and then there was something called NOS. So paraphilia NOS means paraphilia not otherwise specified. And so, for example, let's say you had a foot fetish, and you felt kind of compelled to enjoy feet. But that's, of course, you're compelled to enjoy feet because you have a foot fetish. So if it was compulsive and, you know, and causing you some distress, but still consensual, yes, you'd be mentally ill 3 years ago.
Right. Clinically significant distress.
That's right.
And social, occupational, or relational.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, of course, you're distressed maybe because... There's a lot of reasons you could be distressed. You could be distressed because your partner thinks you're a freak because you're into feet or something, and so now she takes you, or he takes him, or whoever the heck takes that person to a therapist who, up to 3 years ago, could say you have a mental health problem that has a specific diagnosis and label.
Which helps with insurance. I mean, you need to give somebody a label if you want to bill insurance. So even if it's not a clinically significant disorder, you need something to put in the box. So,
yeah.
So sometimes we'll use old labels that really just aren't applicable
anymore. Yeah, you know what I do in that situation, and it's completely appropriate, I use some sort of anxiety, like generalized anxiety.
Right.
Okay, yeah, you're very anxious about your situation, but it's not because you're ill about your fetish.
Right.
It's, yeah, but you're very anxious about everything that's going on around it.
So I have a question. You know, people come to a sex therapist.
Yeah.
I wonder how much time is actually spent talking about sex. I mean, you make people feel comfortable talking about sex.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I mean... How much is there to talk about sex? I mean, do you find that you often get into areas other than just their sexual issues?
I think in many ways a sex therapist is someone who is competently trained in sexuality and feels comfortable talking about it, but in every other respect is a highly trained psychotherapist.
Which is what you are. You were an LCSW.
That's right. So I'm a psychotherapist who, as a sex therapist, I'm competent to talk about issues of sexuality and not only talk about them, but address them in a therapeutic way. But most of what I do is, as you mentioned, is just under the purview of general psychotherapy.
Yeah.
And dealing with people's relationships. I think any sex, I wrote a column about this, I think any sex therapist should also be a good couples therapist.
Sure.
If they're working with systems.
Yeah.
And needs to be a very good psychotherapist, because really it's you're working with human beings who have maybe some issue with their sexuality, but at the core you're going to be using good standard psychotherapy practices with
and
them.
Do you help people come out of the closet, let's say? Because I heard you say at the beginning you deal with two populations.
Yeah.
And one of them is transitioning, and transitioning is a social thing.
You know, coming out of the closet has almost always been associated with being gay or lesbian or
right.
bisexual. People now say they're coming out of the closet for being kinky or being polyamorous. But yes, still with gay individuals, there is still many people who are in somewhere in the process of coming out. And you'd be surprised because there's so much media out there about, look, this is, you know, this is healthy. There's nothing wrong with this. There's a lot of positive messaging out there. But there's a big difference between knowing something on a cognitive level and really believing it inside.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people who may be struggling with maybe some aspect of accepting their sexuality are experiencing an incongruence between what they know and what they believe. Because they know it, they read it, they have access to the internet, but they still haven't resolved their internal feelings around it.
So they understand it on a cognitive level, they haven't necessarily accepted it.
That's right.
Integrated.
Very interesting.
But this is like the fascinating work of psychotherapy, where somebody says, okay, I'm acceptable out there, but I'm not acceptable in here, in my heart.
That's right.
And I'm telling myself I should be, but I can't get there.
You're tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM, WBAI. I'm Ben Starr in the studio here with Kevin O'Donohue and our guest, Dr. Michael Aaron, clinical sexologist and certified sex therapist. Dr. Aaron, I'm wondering how much of that work that you just talked about, helping people come to terms with their own sexualities, is based around shame and overcoming shame and the process by which you guide people through that.
Well, I think shame is one of the core emotions that surface in the area of sexuality. And I think that there's something about societies in general that are conducive to creating sexual shame. We were just talking about this a moment before the show started, and I discuss it in my book. I think that on a societal level, sexuality has always been marginalized and shamed, and I think there are reasons for that. I think a lot of it has to do with group dynamics and how groups are formed. I think one way that groups are formed is by creating barriers and outlining who's to be included and who's to be excluded. And so one famous sociologist, his name escapes me at the moment, but he talked about this idea of deviance as a necessary idea for societies to exist. They need to identify the deviant.
Because it creates cohesion in the in-group.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And so there was a psychoanalyst, his name is Wilfred Bion, who did a lot of work with groups, and he used this term assumption groups, and he was using it in a clinical setting, meaning in his work with groups within his office, he noticed kind of three different trends emerging. And one is that the group is looking for an authority figure. So if you take a look at throughout history, groups are always seeking some leader. It could be a guru, you know. It's a sad part of history, but Hitler, in many ways, was chosen by initially he was a favorite of certain people. It's not like he took force later on,
right.
But he took power at a time when people were looking for a strong figure amidst economic chaos.
Sure.
So that's an example of people seeking an authority figure. So that's one aspect of groups. The other is something called fight or flight. So they're seeking, they're always on the lookout and vigilant for their own survival. And so they're seeking, and this goes back to what we talked about deviance, they're always seeking to identify the enemy. And if there is no enemy, they have to identify an enemy in order to coalesce the group around some specific focus. Mm. And the name escapes me, but the group needs to survive. So one thing to survive that the group needs to do is procreate. So they're always going to privilege what they feel are procreative activities over things that are hedonistic,
right,
or about just individual gratification and self-pleasure, because that doesn't promulgate the survival of the group.
And that leads to, you know, things we hear like women and children first in any emergency.
That's right.
That's about, right, maintaining the future of the in-group, as you call it.
That's
maintaining
right.
The future of the society, of the whatever group we're talking about.
Yeah, so here we have a perfect storm where people, because of their sexuality, if it is non-normative, which simply just means it's not part of the majority, it's not some sort of value-laden term. They're an easy target for being identified as the outlier, as the deviant object around which the in-group finds as a target. Any kind of sex that isn't sort of, mononormative, heteronormative, missionary having babies is going to be frowned upon within this model of understanding how groups are formed, because it's about individual pleasure, not about collectivist survival.
So I have a question for you about groups. In the last few years, we've seen more and more talk of the transgender community.
Yeah.
It seems it's become more and more of a high-profile issue.
Sure.
Why do you think that's happening now, or that it's come to the forefront somewhat recently?
Well, I think there's been a progression, and it's been waves. And so I think the first and most important thing that's contributed to social progress when it comes to sexuality and gender is feminism, and feminism has its roots many years ago. This is not a new thing, but feminism, and I mentioned this in my book, women got the right to vote at a sort of around the same time that there started to be advertising directed specifically at them. So when they started developing some economic clout as a collective group, and advertisers started to focus on them as a group that has purchasing power, then they started developing political power, and they got the right to vote and more equality and so on and so forth. And then we have the gay rights movement. We also had the civil rights movement, and then the gay rights movement, from a chronological perspective, came after that. And I think the transgender movement, in terms of transgender acceptance, is part of that lineage. And people really wrapping their minds around being able to identify equality and challenge their myths around sort of old patriarchal or traditional myths and stereotypes. And when they start to wrap their mind around one group, then they say, well, hold on. Are we also wrong about these other folks? And so I think there's sort of like a...
Would you say that maybe transgender is sort of the final frontier, or do you think there will be further groups beyond that we start to accept more into the mainstream?
No, there are many groups. I'm just chuckling because I think some people, when they hear this, might find it, if they've never heard of it, they might find it kind of strange or just odd because they've never heard it before. But now there's people who identify as other kin, which other kin means trans species. So they feel that they're half human and maybe half wolf or something. And they've developed online communities around this. And they're talking about the fact that, obviously I'm not half wolf, but this is how I strongly identify. There are people who identify as trans-abled. There are people who identify as trans-racial.
Well, what would trans-abled be?
So someone who is disabled is somebody who has some physical challenge. So people who are trans-abled are folks who are able-bodied, but identify, either seek out or identify as their identities being more akin to the psychology of someone who is disabled. So these things are...
Would you say that's a form of body dysmorphia?
It could be. You know what? Here's the thing. A lot of times in the past, some of these psychoanalysts considered transgenderism as a form of body dysmorphia. And so I think we need more information before we jump to conclusions or labels. My process as a therapist, and this is something that I learned in graduate school, and this is how I approach life, is meet the person where they're at. I want to understand what their experience is. I want to understand what their subjective reality is. I want to join with them in the sense that they understand that I get them. I'm not judging them. I'm with them. I want to help them. And we can go from there. I think that... there's definitely, though, there's a psychiatrist at Columbia University, Michael Few, I believe is his name. I might be butchering it, but he's a psychiatrist at Columbia whose specialty is with folks who deeply desire to have a limb cut off. And in his research, he has identified that there is something, differences in their
brain
physiology,
chemistry.
In their brain.
Yeah.
These are not people who are... you know, woke up and had a bad day.
Is that phantom limb syndrome?
Yeah.
Phantom limb?
No, that's the opposite.
That's the opposite.
Yeah, that's people who are missing a limb and who...
Oh, and believe that they...
Well, they feel the sensation still.
Right. Yeah.
But, I mean, so what can we do to help someone like that? I mean, would it be medically ethical to, say, amputate the limb, or how can we...
Well, this is a challenging thing, and I think this goes to kind of some of... There's a lot of debates in terms of how to approach transgender folks, and it's a very hot topic in the field of sexology and sexuality. There was a guy who worked at this center in Toronto, CAMH, Center of Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, who was working with gender nonconforming kids. I'm going to tie it to what you said in a second. He was working with gender nonconforming kids and trying to get them to conform more to their gender so that they wouldn't turn out to be transgender. And so he was trying to steer them away.
This is not in North Carolina. This is in Toronto.
Yeah.
So you're saying this guy was trying to steer these kids away from being trans.
That's right. The truth of the matter is, and his argument was that most gender nonconforming kids just turn out to be gay or lesbian. They're not trans. But my argument would be, they're going to turn out to be whatever the heck they are without your intervention. And so they're going to turn out to be gay, but not transgender or whatever, just because that's how they evolve. And your interventions, to me, and the argument by the transgender community is that this is a form of reparative therapy. And there's a lot of kind of conflict around that. So why I'm kind of tying it into what you're saying is there's an organization called WPATH, which has it's an organization that focuses on transgender issues, and they've made an outline of appropriate protocol or ethics in working with transgender clients. And, you know, one of the ideas is that, you're just working with where the client is at. You're not trying to push them into anything or change them, and you're not trying to give them gender reassignment surgery when they're 6 years old. Yeah. You just let it, let's see where it goes. And when the person has perspective and they're of a certain age, and then we go through a process of exploration.
Yeah,
that's
another controversial thing we can talk about is the younger kids who are, you know, feeling, you know, a little bit of trying to think about how they feel in terms of gender and how we approach, you know, helping those kids out. But this is very threatening to a lot of people. For some reason, people feel, you know, people that have, you know, that are not really... don't have anything to do with these sexual minorities, as you describe them, or alternative sexualities. People take it personally, which always kind of amazed me, because from my personal standpoint, as long as sex happens between consenting adults, then, you know, do what you want to do. I mean, that to me is almost obvious. But, I, of course, a lot of people don't see it that way. And I want to talk with you about that after the break. I also want to give our listeners the opportunity to ask you a question they might have. We're sitting here with Dr. Michael Aaron again. He's a clinical sexologist and certified sex therapist here in New York City. And we're going to go to the phones after we take a short musical break with any questions you may have for Dr. Aaron. The number to call is 212-757-5555. You tune into The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back after this.
Been in every bar, been in every honky-tonk, been trying to find my daddy with that broke-down piece of junk. Ask everyone to help me, cried, help me if you can. You know my daddy, he's that trombone-playing man. Where is my daddy? Tell me, where's my daddy? With that big long sliding thing. I even ask a man that played a steel guitar. He said that you don't need him to be moved 8 to the bar. He brought his amplifier and he hitched it in my plug. He planked it and he plunked it, but it just wasn't good enough. 'Cause I need my daddy with that big long sliding thing. Well, then a knock came at my door. I said, my daddy's back. I opened up the door, and there stood Piano Jack. He said, I came to do some tinkling on your piano keys. I said, don't make me nervous. This ain't no time to tease. Just send me my daddy. Send me my daddy with that big long sliding thing. Well, the first time he played, I asked him how it was done. He said, I blow through here, then I work my fingers and my thumb. I slide it right out, then I slide it back again, and I get a lot of wind, and then I slide it back again.
Dinah Washington here on 99.5 FM WBAI. You're listening to The Positive Mind. I'm Ben Starr here in the studio with Kevin O'Donohue and Dr. Michael Aaron, who is a clinical sexologist, a certified sex therapist. You've read his columns in Men's Health and Psychology Today. He has a book coming out, which is called Modern Sexuality. Is that right? Modern Sexuality?
That's right. It's coming out in October.
Coming out in October, available from Roman and Littlefield, so keep your eyes peeled for that. We wanted to take some calls, give you guys the opportunity to ask Dr. Aaron some questions. We have Justine on the line. Justine, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. I'm a transgender woman, and when I was going through my transition, I started to read, you know, some of the gender theorists and what, you know, what's often called gender studies today. And along the way, I stumbled over the whole academic field of disability studies, something I was completely unaware of before that. And I found that, you know, there was a lot of cross-interest between those two areas. You know, a lot of people working in one were working in the other or had some affiliation with the other. And I'm an amateur at all of this. You know, I'm not an academic gender theorist or anything like that. But it occurs to me that I think that, you know, apart from the sympathy and the empathy that we feel for each other, I think that one reason why there's such an alliance between the two is because those of us who identify differently from societal norms when it comes to gender or sexuality, do you feel that, at least until we start enabling ourselves, you know, through transition or coming out of the closet or whatever, that we are disabled. Like, I'll give you an example. I had difficulty with relationships because, and, you know, with both men and women, because I could not, you know, because in my male body at the time, living as a male, I could not function as a woman. And I felt, in a way, that that was a kind of disability. And I talked to other trans people who, you know, who have or have had similar feelings to that. And I'm wondering if that, you know, maybe that's the connection, or that is a connection between, gender theory, gender studies, and disability studies, or disability theory.
What do you think?
Well, I think that's a very interesting point. It's a very interesting idea. I think that part of the discussion is also, I think it's multidisciplinary. One aspect is also you identify gender theory, I think there's also this is a good time to bring up queer theory, which is a kind of another interdisciplinary academic approach that incorporates a lot of these kinds of ideas. But the queer, it's been generally associated with just being gay or lesbian, but generally it means non-binary. And so there's a lot of research now and people writing about the fact that people are not necessarily black or white. They're not very male or very female, or they're not necessarily very straight or very gay, and there's a lot of fluidity. And I think that when we kind of open up the discussion about fluidity when it comes to sexuality and about fluidity in identity, it opens up the door to a lot of people having a voice to talk about their own personal experiences.
Mm-hmm. I think it also ties into what you said about kids having gender reassignment surgery at age 6, which is something I'm against. And I get some flack for that. And I think what, you know, childhood, what adolescence should be about is experimentation. You know, kids doing whatever they have to do to find out who they are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if a boy wants to play with Barbie dolls, you know, well, so be it. You know, maybe he'll grow out of it, quote unquote, or maybe, you know, he'll find himself there. You know, just as if, if a girl wants to, wants to play with her brother's Erector set,
yeah,
which I always thought was kind of a funny name for a toy, but, I had one, by the way, as a kid.
I totally agree, Justine, and I think what it comes down to is just letting people be who they are, giving people space to be themselves, and to let that be a judgment-free thing that that people can just kind of be themselves without any judgments or aspersions there,
and leaving space for people to be confused.
Yeah,
I mean, if you're 8 years old and you're confused.
But I want to thank you for the call, Justine, because we want to get as many people in today as possible.
Sure.
So thanks for tuning in and thanks for the call.
Do you find that transgender people sometimes do suffer with a sense of disability, or that they're identified with a disabled part of themselves, or they're wounded? How does this work out in therapy? I mean, what are some of the issues, the anxieties, the questions of transgender clients?
I think that folks who have experienced a lot of trauma, my start in the field was in harm reduction, and I did outreach work with transgender sex workers. And these are folks who are doing street sex work, outdoor work. And these have been folks who are very marginalized and oppressed and kicked out of their family of origins.
So they have to feel wounded on some
level.
I just want to put the number out there for callers. We're talking with Michael Aaron, clinical sexologist and sex therapist, with a new book out called Modern Sexuality. Give us a call, 212-757-5555. If you have any questions about any of the issues we're talking about, 212-757-5555.
Just a quick bookend. We've had, to what the previous caller was talking about, just very quickly, just to kind of give an idea to wrap that part up.
Yeah.
But there, we have experiences in the past of horrible psychotherapy gone awry that has had devastating effects. In the 1970s in UCLA, there was something called the Sissy Boy Experiments, where parents brought their sissy boys, sissy, it was the word that they used.
Gosh.
These were effeminate boys that were going to have that femininity whipped out of them. And, you know, they were subjected to harsh treatment, even beatings, to my understanding, just so that they toughened up and became masculine. And the researchers claimed in the academic journals that it was a great success. But, you know, we know about what happened to some of these folks, and they were very depressed and they committed suicide. And it's just we have horrible examples of what happens when we try to change somebody in terms of who they are with some well-meaning, perhaps, but really harmful therapeutic interventions.
Yeah, societal pressure, parental or family pressure. Totally bizarre and backwards. Only 40 years ago. Now, what do you do? Do you ever get a client who wants you to talk them out of their sexuality? I mean, talk me out of being gay, or talk me into being trans? I mean, people are so confused that they're asking you for what they should do, who they are. Well, I mean, that's not good therapy to tell a client who they are, but, yeah. You know.
Well, it's an exploration process. I think what you're talking about there is that a lot of folks come in with a high level of ambivalence. You know, the word that was used before in psychoanalytic circles that I reject, I don't like, is resistance. But a lot of folks experience ambivalence, which means a part of them wants something and a part of them doesn't.
Right.
A part of them wants it because, you know, it feels authentic, and but a part of them fears change. You know, changing is painful and requires a process of having to look at some difficult things. And it's easier just to do nothing. So, or it may feel that way. So when I work with my clients, and a lot of them do experience a lot of ambivalence, I try to normalize it. And this is the example I use. I say, look, we have ambivalence about everything. So, for example, have you ever walked down a street, it's a summer day, and there's an ice cream truck there? Part of you says, you know, I would really like that delicious ice cream on this hot summer day. But maybe a part of you says, well, how many calories is that going to be? Because, right. You know, because if I eat that, I'm trying to be on a diet or something. So that's an example how even on a daily basis, we're fighting with ourselves. So it's okay to feel ambivalent about some aspect of your sexuality. It's normal.
Right, which is a great idea. I hope the psychology departments include ambivalence as one of the defenses that clients show up with in a therapy hour. Ambivalence, and to normalize it, and to make it feel like this is an item of conversation. We don't have to spend months dealing with your resistance. Let's just talk about your ambivalence. It's a great idea. But, from all that you're saying, it does get down to this idea of shame.
Mm-hmm.
And you must be an expert on shame.
Well, I hear a lot about it. And I think that shame is a very important emotion to understand. I think it's a core emotion. I'm very influenced by something called affect theory, which was created by a psychologist named Sylvan Tompkins, where just like you have primary colors, right, red, yellow, and blue, and then you have secondary colors where red and yellow make orange and red and blue is purple and all that. Same here, where he kind of analyzed emotions and he found that there were some core emotions.
Yeah.
And shame is one of these core emotions. Interestingly enough, he identified, and since then other people have been working on it, this guy Paul Ekman, it's evolved.
Like Adler started it, kind of with inferiority, like everybody has an inferiority part to them.
Yeah, he did focus a lot on that. Tompkins identified that in his theory, and it's been evolving, there were two core positive emotions, one neutral, and the rest, I think six of them were negative.
28 negative.
Negative. There's a lot more negative, and shame is one of them. And I think shame is really important to understand because also at its core, there's two main things that are important to understand, which is the difference between shame and guilt. And here's why.
Yeah, sure.
Because people get them confused. Guilt is about feeling bad about something we did. Yeah. Shame is feeling bad about who we are.
Right.
And so why I'm saying that, and I'm introducing this idea of shame and guilt, is because for us to feel bad about who we are, we had to have learned that somewhere.
Sure.
We're not just, it's not a blank slate where we're born and at the age of 3 months, we feel bad about who, we learn that someone externally, something.
There are ideas that we then internalize.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So shame is derived from external stimuli, which as a result, often shame is associated with anger because if someone makes you feel really bad, you're going to be shamed and angry because that came from outside of you.
Right.
Let's take another call real quick. We have Rachel on the line. Rachel, you there?
Yes.
Hi, thanks for calling in. You have a question for Dr. Aaron?
Yeah. Do you ever consider their gender instead of trans? I'm trans. I call myself third gender because it's biblically a base. I feel that you even proved it today that trans has so much connected to it that people have all sorts of perceptions of trans people. And those perceptions are always negative. They're very rarely positive, and they never really judge us for who we are. They always judge us for who we appear to be in whoever they think we are. And so therefore, we're always prejudged and never judged for who we are. And that's why we're relegated to the bottom of society. If you notice, you say you deal with a lot of trans people in the sex work area. that's because there's really no other work available because of the misconceptions and things.
Well, Rachel, let me interrupt you a second. So beyond being transgender, who are you?
I can prove it biblically, but the people don't like to talk about the Bible.
No, but who do you want to talk about? When you talk about yourself beyond transgender.
Okay, who I am. See, I'm a religious person. I always felt I was in rebellion against the Bible until I found the passage in the Bible in Isaiah 56, 1 through 5, that really speaks to us as a third gender people. It speaks of a third gender. I could read it to you if you like, but
no,
I know people don't like to read.
No, it's okay.
Don't like
I'm
to
just,
hear the Bible.
I'm just trying to get a sense of who you are.
No, that's well, that's the yeah. only way I can well,
okay.
give you a sense of who I am.
I got it. So
let me just add to what Rachel makes some good points. Let me just add in, there's other cultures, and I don't remember what they all are, but there are various other cultures that do recognize a third gender. And some of these are sort of...
Do you know the basis of it, though? That's what I'm trying to give you, the basis of it. But and I gave you the chapter and verse.
Uh-huh. Yeah, did you hear the discussion?
But you would have
about,
to read it. Oh, I could read it to you.
I know, but we talked about the three main groups. One is an authoritarian group. The other is the fight or flight group. And the other is the survival group. And we're trying...
I understand that.
Yeah, and we're just trying...
But what I'm saying is that this is outside of your box. And so you have to be willing to bring in other things that you may not be familiar with, but you have to at least be willing to consider them.
Well, why don't you give us the verse and we'll check it out afterwards?
I can read it to you now.
No, we have another caller on the line. We just
wanted
to get
quality over quantity, you know.
Right, right, right.
Well, okay, let's hear the verse.
Okay. This is Isaiah 56, and it goes from, I'm going to read from 1 to 5, and it says this. Thus says the Lord, keep ye judgment and do justice, for my salvation is near to come, and my righteousness to be revealed. Blessed is the man that does this, and the son of man that layeth hold of it, that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and keepeth his hand from doing any evil. Neither let the son of the stranger that has joined himself to the Lord speak, saying, the Lord has utterly separated me from his people. Neither let the eunuch, and there you go, say, behold, I am a dry tree. For thus says the Lord, unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbath and choose the things that please me and take hold of my covenant, even unto them will I give in my house and within my walls a place and a name better, here it comes, better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them within my walls, I will defend my walls, a place and a name, better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Now, if you're speaking of eunuchs, why should you say of daughters? It's speaking of a broader category.
I understand. Rachel, it sounds like from the reading, you know, that you're reading it in a way that that tells you that there is an indication there that their reference is to trans or even third gender, as you say. And I appreciate that, and we'll definitely read into it.
Why do you doubt it? I can make the point. The point is that he's speaking of gender, not sex, but gender.
Okay.
There's the first gender, there's the third gender, and it says, I will give you a place better than, I will give you a name and a place better than of sons, which is what some are called, and of daughters. I will give you a name and a place, and that speaks of a third gender.
Well, listen, Rachel, I do appreciate the call, but we have to make some space for other callers to come in and participate
today. Okay, it's Isaiah 56:1-5.
Thank you very much. Isaiah 56:1-5. Rachel, thanks for the call. 212-757-5555 is the number to call. It'd be great to get a couple more callers in. We're up against the end of the hour. But
what about Unix, Michael? Anything about Unix?
Well, I mean, there have been Unix throughout history, and it's individuals, men who have had their testicles removed, and they've had them removed for a number of reasons. Unix refers to someone who's had a process of having their testicles removed, and again, in history, it's been for a number of reasons. And I think we're probably getting a little bit away from the conversation, sort of at that point.
Right. Which is about shame, and which is about people accepting themselves and who they are.
And identity and sexuality and how the two are connected and how the two play off of each other. And you know, it's great to have you on here today, Dr. Aaron, because there's really so much that we can learn from your experience and the work that you've done. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about possibly having you back, which would be great.
I just want to say we talked a lot about sexology today, and I'd like to talk about sex therapy. Maybe we can have them on for another show where we talk mostly about sex therapy. I mean, these issues are really, really important. I think you touched on a major therapy issue of shame when dealing with people who are dealing with their sexuality. For instance, you do have people who are out of the closet who are dealing with shame. This is a common issue in your office.
Well, there's a term called internalized homophobia. That basically means that someone is gay, but they still have internalized a lot of negative self-beliefs about that orientation. And I think, you know, I've noticed, I spoke at the Gay Center sometime last year on some sexuality-related topic, and most of my audience there at the Gay Center were millennials, so these are 20-somethings. And when I talked about internalized homophobia, they looked at me like I had four eyes. They didn't know what I was talking about. But I think that older folks, meaning people who came of age maybe before the year 2000, before the internet really blew up, have really, really struggled with internalized and still do struggle. And because you've gone your whole life hiding who you are or getting messages that are negative about your identity. So it's very difficult just at the snap of your fingers to discard all of these learnings that you've accumulated over a lifetime.
It's kind of like Pearl's concept of the negative parental introject.
Indeed.
Where you take in the negative aspects of your parent, your severe parent, or whatever labels you want, and introject them to try and master them.
Well, you know,
and take control over them.
That's a very good point. And what a lot of folks struggle with is this internal self-critic. And inevitably, they've had an authoritarian parent who is very critical of them and very rejecting. I think there's an institutionalized homophobia that people have experienced that is sort of a parental figure in the form of society. But one thing that I want to work with people is to be challenged that self-critical talk.
Great. How can people get in touch with you, Michael?
Well, my website is Dr. Michael Aaron, NYC, Dr. Michael, then Aaron is AAronNYC.com. You can Google me, Dr. Michael Aaron. I'm all over the internet, so you can readily find me there.
And we're going to talk about your blog tomorrow or next time you can come in, because you have a lot of great articles there.
Absolutely. Sure. And I want to thank you again, Dr. Aaron, for being here. Again, it's Dr. Michael Aaron, clinical sexologist, certified sex therapist. You can catch his upcoming book, Modern Sexuality. That's going to be available from Roman and Littlefield. And he's all over the internet, as he says. So check him out online. Appreciate all your insight today, Dr. Aaron, and it'd be great to have you back. Again, you've been listening to The Positive Mind, 99.5 FM, WBAI. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Take care.